It's officially 2026, and my New Year's resolution is to prioritize high-quality pieces in my wardrobe. Thanks to Quince, I can already check that off my list. I'm already planning outfits around my new cotton Oxford shirt. It's such a classic, timeless piece that I know I'll be rewearing all year. Need more than just a wardrobe update? Quince has tons of options for the home as well. Maya has had the same dinnerware since college and has finally decided it's time for a refresh, starting with a gorgeous set of ceramic cake plates. Refresh your wardrobe with Quince. Don't wait. Go to quince.com/rehash for free shipping on your order and 365-day returns. Now available in Canada, too. That's quince.com/rehash to get free shipping and 365-day returns. quince.com/rehash.
Good morning.
Good morning. It is definitely 2 p.m. But good morning to ya.
Top of the morning to ya.
Oh, Hannah is Irish.
It's true. I've said this on Twitter, but my aunt was married in the church from the Banshees of Inisherin, and I was there.
That little fucking donkey. I think about her when I wake up in the morning, and I think about her when I go to bed at night.
I know. I'm like, firstborn child, gonna be named Jenny. Secondborn child, gonna be named Jenny.
What's his name? Colin Farrell's name?
Oh, Padraic.
Porrick.
Porrick. which is the Irish version of Patrick. It's Porrick O'Sullivan. No, O'Sullivan. O'Sullivan. It's like the Irish version of that, but I can't remember how to pronounce it.
Yeah, it's pretty crazy. Yeah. I'm not even going to try.
Gaelic names and spelling and all of that is just like, it's scary territory.
Scary territory.
How are you, Maya?
I'm not great. I've been better. I've had a bad new start to the new year. I think we both have. It's been like this is why our episode's coming out late. It's just been a bit of a fucking rough time for you and I think.
Yeah, 2023 is like not that girl. At least not yet.
Not that girl. We both had a pretty rancid New Year's Eve, like just all of a rancid stinky vibes.
We did this thing that you're not supposed to do, which is where we got really, really excited about New Year's Eve and we're like, it's actually going to be the best night ever. And in my head, I was like, I know you're not supposed to do this, but I think that I might be right this year because I'm like taking destiny into my hands and it's going to be like fun.
You really have to make your own fun. And we tried our best to make our own fun.
Yeah. This is not for lack of trying. Like we get an A for effort.
We get an A for effort, but the rest of everything gets an F for farts.
F for farts.
Rancidness. Yeah. And then my grandma passed away, which, you know, it's been a tough time. But now we're here and we're doing an episode and we're excited to be back because I think this has been something that we both love to do. Hannah's been really sick also.
I have had an unknown virus. I've been calling it the flu, but I don't know if it's that.
She tested for COVID and it was negative, which we are all confused.
But I'm like basically on the mend. I sound sick probably right now because I sound sick.
We went this whole week where we legit lived together, just the two of us, and we did not see each other for an entire week because Hannah was like in her room isolating. I was like running in and out of the house all week long, like planning things.
I know. What did you say that I was? A voice behind the door?
Oh yeah, she was like this disembodied voice that I would just kind of hear, be like, hi Hannah. She'd be like, hi. Yeah, it was a time that we both needed to give each other a big hug and we couldn't. It was very sad.
I know, like, for your own good, could not give you a hug, but wanting to. But you guys are kind of catching us in our catch up because this is the first time we've been able to spend time together in like almost a week.
Yeah. We literally sat down and this is the first thing we did together.
Yeah, because always be hustling.
And that is exactly what this episode will be about. So who are you, Hannah?
I'm Hannah. I'm Maya's best friend. Somebody call me your assistant on New Year's Eve.
Thus adding to the absolute horrors of New Year. Yes. Hannah got absolutely degraded.
No, obviously it'd be an honor to be your assistant.
Absolutely not.
But I'm not your assistant.
She is not.
But I am your best friend. Yeah.
Hannah's my best friend.
And what are you? Who are you?
I'm Maya. I'm Hannah's best friend. Aww. And right now I'm looking at, I'm a patron of Hannah's beautiful knitting. That's who I am.
She's being overly kind. I've knit like a monstrosity of yarn. It looks like someone threw up a bag of yarn.
And she looks so dang cute in it.
I'm calling it fashion.
Kamala Harris's daughter wears that exact kind of shit.
That it really is. She really I am going for like Pinterest knitting influencer BB.
Yeah, I think it looks good. And this is Rehash, a podcast about the social media phenomenons that strike a nerve in our culture, only to be quickly forgotten, but we think are due for a revisiting. This season is on the public theater, which is all about our collective fascination with a good public villain. If you like our show and you want to hear more from us, you can support us on Patreon at patreon.com/rehashpodcast, where we have monthly bonus episodes, weekly minisodes, and early access to our regular programming. If you don't want to join the Patreon, feel free to just rate and review us on Spotify and Apple Podcasts, because that helps us out a lot.
But the Patreon is actually really fun.
It is really fun. You will be missing like really funny, hilarious, the top tier content.
There is an hour-long episode of us going through the like Nepo Babies article and like getting drunk while doing it.
On Bailey's. So you can imagine.
And it is so stupid.
We were being very out of pocket. So if you want to hear us being out of pocket, join the Patreon.
And today's episode is about Diet Prada.
We're so excited about this one. Remember the first time you came across Diet Prada on Instagram?
I actually don't. I must have heard about it from like Oyster Magazine or Dazed and Confused. I used to read those a lot, I think around the time that Diet Prada came out. Or I might have learned about it from Man Repeller. Spoiler alert, future ep. I don't even remember what year that was. My early 20s, late teens is like this big messy blob, and I don't know what happened when.
You don't remember like the first post you came across or anything like that?
I don't. I'm sorry. I'm a flop.
I do. I remember mine. Okay, so my history with them, of coming across them. Well, my Instagram explore page is basically just like a Pinterest fashion mood board. What's yours like?
Mine is accounts that repost paparazzi photos of like B-list celebrities.
We're not shocked, Hannah.
It was like there's an absurd amount of planned paparazzi photos of like Lucy Hale drinking a smoothie.
I'm gobsmacked.
Yeah, I'm like actually like have dirt for brain.
No. She's like legitimately crying right now. Like there are tears coming.
Stop, my lung capacity is so weak right now.
Well, like I'm pretty happy that my sorry, Hannah. I'm pretty happy with my explore page because it's really just like a no thoughts, just vibe situation for me. Like that's every beautiful time I open the app. And I got logged out of my Tumblr. I can't get back in ever again. You know when Tumblr did that to people? So like I actually can never log back into my beautiful Tumblr, which means that this kind of has just become my Tumblr.
She won't become a Pinterest girl.
I find Pinterest, the interface, so messy and ugly.
I don't get it. I live for Pinterest. But moving on.
But yeah, because of this, because I have this kind of mood boardy, like whatever, Instagram, very fashion focused, I stumbled across Diet Prada back in like very early, like I think January 2018. And the first post I kind of came across, for some reason, I still remember it. I don't know why. But it was this carousel post of kind of split images, which were comparing like two photos side by side. The caption on the post begins with this. It says, "Celeb exposure can be game changing for small brands. But the downside, given your clothes land on the right girls, is that they make you extremely vulnerable to knockoffs." And then they go on to talk about the indie label Daisy Daisy TV. I don't know if you've heard of them. Mm-mm. But basically their dresses have been worn by Bella Hadid and Kendall Jenner within a really short time frame back then. And then dupes of their dresses had quickly ended up on fast fashion sites like Tiger Mist and IMGEA. I really liked this post. I think it really embodies the fact that Diet Prada does this really great job of lining up images in such a way that it's really obvious how much cheaper the fast fashion ones are compared to the originals. You would never notice it if you didn't put them side by side.
Yeah, I remember like back then it was pretty crazy. Like there was no denying the plagiarism. They were very good at that.
Yeah, the very early ones were really clear. So yeah, for a bit of history, Diet Prada was launched anonymously back in 2014 with the intention of exposing copycat designs.
That's so long
ago. I think that they were really working in a very, very small crowd back then. Like, it was very small for many years.
Okay.
I think it was, like, a passion project.
Wait, when did it blow up?
Around 2018.
Okay, makes sense.
2017, 2018. Okay. Much of their early posts were along the lines of what I just said, mostly focusing on calling attention to, like, the blatant plagiarism within the fashion industry. And the way that the system works to keep smaller brands at the bottom of the fashion food chain. So it's kind of this concept of, like, a small brand, all these big brands are feasting off of them, and there's nothing left. Early Dior Prada, I really like to think of it as this distillation of that Miranda Priestly monologue from The Devil Wears Prada, where she, like, bodies Anne Hathaway by, like, insulting her blue sweater. And then she goes, "That blue represents millions of dollars and countless jobs. And it's sort of comical how you think that you've made a choice that exempts you from the fashion industry when, in fact, you're wearing a sweater that was selected for you by the people in this very room from a pile of stuff."
Oh my god, do more. I would love to hear you do the whole thing.
I have more coming.
Oh, she's like, "Well, you pulled it out of some bargain bin, surely," or whatever.
Yeah, she goes, "Some tragic, casual corner where you no doubt fished it out of a clearance bin."
Yes.
But there were occasions even back then where it was hard to tell in their posts what was blatant plagiarism and then what was just inspiration and influence and then what was kind of a complex product of the trickle-down effect that you're talking about, the clearance bin in that monologue. That kind of happens in fashion naturally, regardless of... It's just very hard to tell in the fashion industry. Like, there is a kind of an overlap between influence and plagiarism and trickle-down.
But with when style. It's a small brand, it's like trickle up. Like, it feels like the reverse of that.
Yes, but not, it wasn't all the time that they were calling out small brands. Sometimes it would, or that they were drawing attention to small brands. Sometimes it was like, oh, a fashion label ripped off a big luxury label. Like,
oh,
that kind of thing.
For sure.
Well.
I mean, sometimes you'd be like, oh, this is, they'd be like, this piece that this designer did is clearly a ripoff of the archive of this other famous fashion brand. And that stuff.
That's just influence.
That was like more interesting because you debate, yeah, was it influence? Was it ripped off? Can you really own like a silhouette, especially after it's been like repurposed in so many ways?
Sometimes it was, it felt like a bit of a reach and it didn't feel like they were giving us the opportunity for debate. Like, the comment sections were a good place to debate. Sometimes they would pose a question like, do you think this is inspiration or plagiarism? Sometimes they would just be coming for the jugular. So it was a mixture. They were operating anonymously at this point, but then in 2018, an article by Business Fashion revealed that the account was run by fashion insiders Tony Liu and Lindsay Schuyler, who had met in their mid-20s working as accessory designers for Eugenia Kim. Their account would steadily grow, which meant that Tony and Lindsay were working at a much more rapid pace to accommodate for their rapidly growing audience, with each of them kind of leaving their jobs to pursue Dior Prada full-time.
How
is right.
Right.
So around the time of the Business of Fashion article, the account had already amassed over 400,000 followers, and it was dubbed, quote, "the most feared Instagram account in fashion" by Business Insider. And this really, like, is not an overstatement. They were breaking stories about the fashion industry at a pace and with the freedoms that a regular news outlet wouldn't be able to keep up with. The biggest one is that in 2018, they outed actual ghouls Stefano Gabbana and Domenico Dolce for their explicit anti-Asian racism, which effectively tarnished the company's reputation. Although it's unclear whether this actually had a financial impact, but I know they had to cancel a couple shows, which is a pretty big deal considering how big they are.
I think at least among, like, the younger crowd, I do think so. I've seen people like criticize people like Anya Taylor-Joy and like Emilia Clarke for wearing Dolce.
Yeah, like people are, it's sticking in people's minds. They ruffled D&G's feathers to such an extent as to invite a $665 million lawsuit waged against the two of them the company. Yeah, and it's still lingering.
Stefano Gabbana.
They're actually ghouls, like the worst men ever.
The way he would just comment on like random Instagram photos fans posted of Selena Gomez and be like, "She is ugly to me."
Okay, I'm sorry, I thought it was so bad.
Same with like Ariana Grande, he'd be like, "Ew."
It's so awful. So they also called out their namesake Prada for featuring blackface dolls and like tchotchkes in their store windows, for which the company was forced to apologize.
I think the same thing happened with like Gucci and God, what was it that they were selling?
It was a mask. It was like a, I think a, like a blackface mask. Truly just like crazy.
Yeah.
They've called out Christian Siriano. They've multiple times, many, many times called out the Kardashians. They constantly call out the founder of Who Wore What, Danielle Bernstein.
Yeah, they've had a big impact, I think. Maybe not a huge impact, but like I've seen them post a lot and have ongoing things with influencer fashion brands. So We Were What, that's it.
Who Were What?
Who Were What, and that's...
Oh, it is We Were What, sorry.
We Were What, but there's also another one, like Ariel Charnas, I think that's her name.
Isn't she the Nasty Gal founder?
No, that's Sofia Amoroso.
Oh, true.
But anyways, this was another influencer fashion brand that they probably sold at like Nordstrom's or something.
Yeah.
That they were also calling out for a bunch of shit. And like,
yeah.
I think she was also being whack early pandemic. Anyways.
Yeah, they were coming. They like to come for the girl bosses.
Yes.
Do you remember any other good call-outs that they did?
There was just a lot of times that they did stand up for like small independent designers who were being blatantly ripped off by like larger companies or by people like Danielle Bernstein, because she was, oh my god, like notorious for just having small designers send her stuff and then ripping off those designs.
Yeah,
and
Danielle Bernstein is a ghoul in a whole other way.
Yes, she's a ghoul. But I think that they did provide like an outlet or like a voice to designers that just didn't have that kind of traction against people with whose followings Diet Prada's mirrored. Like they needed somebody who had the same kind of attention that a Danielle Bernstein had in order to draw eyes to the fact that she was doing this.
Totally.
And I, so like, I really do think that they were like a voice for small designers in some capacities.
Yeah, I agree. They were doing like, yeah, pretty big work, I would say.
And like, they seem to be knowledgeable about fashion history and the overall archives of major designers that for me, just starting to get interested in fashion around the time that I started following them, it taught me some stuff. It like exposed me to archival fashion.
Yeah, they're very passionate about fashion, which I think is going to color kind of what we'll, our discussion later. And then around the time of the Black Lives Matter protests back in 2020, they started expanding the range of stuff that they would post, but I mean that they were expanding the range of stuff by a lot. Like, they're really, the boundaries completely collapsed. The way Instagram works, it's really hard for me to scroll all the way back to this time, so I kind of had to do just like a cursory glance from an article. So there's this Vanity Fair article called The Trials of Diet Prada. They kind of does this comprehensive history of them. And it said that they were posting stuff back then about Sports Illustrated's first trans cover model. They were posting about coverage about blackface on TV in Europe. They were posting this, like, there was a celebration post of queer fashion pioneer Rudi Gernreich. I hope I pronounced that right. There was a critique from the left of Juneteenth as being a national holiday. They were posting photos from the set of And Just Like That. They were posting infographics and information about violence against women in Pakistan and Israel-Palestine. And when I look at it today, just to catch up, when I look at it today, the page looks a lot more like a more progressive, more selective, and kind of like lazier BuzzFeed news than an actual fashion, whatever, critic page.
Yeah, I mean, I still follow them, but I genuinely couldn't tell you what they've been posting lately because I've kind of just, I mean, I don't really pay attention to a lot of Instagram anymore, but like I generally drowned them out.
Yeah, I think it's like it's oversaturation. At the time that I was researching this, the first post on their page, I literally had the headline, Prince Harry's new memoir accuses Prince William of physical attack over Meghan Markle criticism. Wow, that we've really come a long way, haven't we?
Yeah, I don't know, it just kind of makes me sad to think about people who worked in fashion, clearly are very passionate about fashion, quit their jobs for this page that was supposed to be about fashion and are now doing like...
It's like minimalist Perez Hilton.
Like fluff journalism a little.
Yeah, it's pop journalism.
Kind of a weird turn.
Yeah. I think it's time for me to address the elephant in the room. The elephant that is only between me and Hannah because no one else would know this information. Back in 2019, in my pre-YouTube days.
Only 2019?
Yeah.
Honestly, dude, time goes by fast, but also so slow.
So slow. So back in 2019, in my pre-YouTube days, Diet Prada and I got into a scrap.
Yeah, when she was just a little nobody.
I was just a little
like Anna Kendrick. Like Anna Kendrick. Yeah, that's the name of her memoir.
Do you remember that Instagram page, You've Got No Mail? You hated Anna Kendrick.
So I saw him once at Dumbo House in New York. It's like a Soho House offshoot. My ex-boyfriend's friend from university has like a membership to Soho House, so we would like go there when we were visiting, because it was like, oh, Soho House.
No, not Soho House.
Went to Dumbo House, no. And we were like, we went to the pool, but we didn't, like, we didn't have swimsuits or anything. We weren't going swimming. We just, like, sat in chairs by the pool. And I had been seeing a lot of celebrities on this trip, so I was like, who am I going to see at Dumbo House? But it was You've Got No Mail, and I was kind of embarrassed that I recognized him. He's walking around. I think he had, like, a stuffed animal backpack on.
Oh, yeah, very much. He had a very Montreal vibe.
Later on that trip, because he's friends with Rose McGowan, and later on that trip, I saw Rose McGowan out with some other people, but,
and
like, not him.
You've Got No Mail. No. Wow, the world is tiny.
But I was like, yeah, truly.
Wild. I can't find the post in question anymore. But basically, and this is what I kind of want to focus on in this episode, they had posted footage of this objectively hideous Y3 runway show. If you don't know, Y3 is a kind of athleisure collaboration between Japanese fashion legend Yohji Yamamoto and Adidas. It was launched back in 2002 and has since become the uniform of 15-year-old hypebeasts everywhere. Do you have any opinions on Y3, Hannah?
Not really. I don't have a lot of overlapping fashion interests with hypebeasts particularly. And I think it's crazy the amount of like designers that collaborate with Adidas.
I know, it's wild, because I love Yohji Yamamoto, but I don't know, something about Y3, maybe it's just, like, the way the culture is, like, taken it, and it's, like, it's a permeated the culture I just don't like, but I'm not a fan. Now, remember, at this time, Dia Prada was being really merciless about their takes on what they thought was and wasn't ugly in the world of fashion. Like, they were coming for the jugular every time. And then here they are, sitting front row, or close to front row, at this Y3 show. Like, a brand that they would usually roast, honestly. Filming some of the ugliest stuff I have ever seen waltz down the runway and praising it. And when I say that they were reaching, like, they were fucking reaching to compliment these designs. So I, being bored and writing an essay about, like, Marx's left nut or something, as was typical for me back then.
Yeah, she went to McGill and she...
No, I was in Toronto at the time.
Oh, yeah. She is a master's. Also, sorry, I completely, like, didn't process your joke about Marx's left nut.
Yeah, it's our hilarious, but it's, yeah.
Okay.
So, yeah, I commented on the post. I love how often I bring up the times that I comment in comment sections.
This
it's, like,
whole
something
thing
that
is
no
just
one...
exposing my as, like, being as a little troll on her computer.
It's, like, something no one would ever like to admit to anyone. No, but I admit it, like, on every chance I get when I'm candid.
I admitted to being in that stupid West Elm Caleb Toronto Facebook group, which, again, I was in out of, like, curiosity, not because I actually would be in one of those groups, but I'm actually really embarrassed now because now people might think that I was in it because I would be someone who would be in one of those groups. We're all embarrassed.
This was
a
time, like, it's like, I did not comment on stuff very often. I commented on my Instagram account. Like, it was, like, my name, my face, like, you know, public account. So I was like, I'm going to put myself out there because I actually just, like, feel like I need to say this.
Yeah, you wouldn't do that now, and you wouldn't do that with, like...
I couldn't do it now, yeah. But I commented on the post. I can't remember exactly what I said, but basically it was kind of along the lines of something about how if Dia Prada wanted to be respected and understood as, like, a third-party objective observer that instills, like, checks and balances within the fashion industry, then, like, I personally thought it was pretty unethical that they were being sponsored by fashion brands to review their shows. To me, that's a serious conflict of interest. I can't remember if the post was explicitly a sponsored post now. This was still, like, in the early days of Instagram going, like, full-on corporate. But anyways, my comment got, you know, like, a few likes. I feel like it was responded to okay. But then Dia Prada, who were known for, like, ruthlessly clapping back at, like, random commenters around this time, responded to me. Again, like, I can't give you verbatim here, but it was along the lines of something saying that they hadn't been paid by Y3, only that they had been invited to go to their show. Which, like, sure, so there's no, like, financial incentive there. But there still is a partnership being involved, or there still is some sort of, like, communication between you and the brand.
Well, yeah, and not all relationships are transactional in, like, a monetary sense.
Especially in this industry.
I do remember this time where Dia Prada was suddenly posting from fashion shows. They weren't just, you know, looking at like the Vogue pictures online of their runway. They were like actually there.
They were there.
I remember them posting from the Met Gala.
Wow.
And being like,
yeah,
aren't you one supposed to be anonymous? How are you showing up at an in-person event? But two, this feels weird.
Yeah, it was very like something about it felt icky.
Oh, they weren't at the Met Gala. Sorry, they were at like the preview of the Met exhibition.
Yeah, I remember that. Yeah.
Sorry.
But still though, I wish I could remember the rest of their response to me because it was really aggressive and like bitchy in tone. But I just don't want to misquote them. And every time a person disagreed with me in the thread, because like, whatever, they have a lot of fans, they would go and like the person's comment. Like, it was like they were revisiting the thread. I was like, damn, you guys have a lot of time on your hands for like a really big account.
Well, they did quit their jobs.
That's true. Which like, I can't talk. But obviously, like, they being an account with like well over 500,000 followers, like ratioed me into oblivion. Something I, again, keep talking about how I get ratioed in comment sections. So embarrassing. But honestly, like, all I took away from this was that they seemed like pretty insecure about the criticism I was waging at them. Like, when I get criticized on YouTube, the criticisms that upset me the most are ones that I believe to have a bit of truth in them. I honestly, like, prefer incels calling me like a dumb puritanical bitch, because to me, that's not true. I commented because at this point, I had seen a few posts, like you were saying, like this from them, that were kind of like half sponsored and just gave me this really icky feeling. And then I had also seen them being like really mean in their comment sections and really out of pocket with people. Just something about them had just really turned me off. Like, I unfollowed them after this. Not just because they responded to me, I was already kind of growing disillusioned by them. But yeah, that's when I kind of
severed the ties,
which they don't fucking care. But so
I bet they care now. I bet now hearing them about this, they're like, wow, if only we knew then what we know now.
I unfollowed them and I said, one day you will be ruining this moment. So Hannah,
yes,
if you were to summarize what Diet Prada is in one word, what word would that be? Like, what would its job title be if it had one?
Diet Prada at peak Diet Prada, or Diet Prada today?
Diet Prada at peak Diet Prada.
I guess a watchdog, right? I mean, that's what it was supposed to be. It was supposed to be people who really had their eyes on the fashion industry and who cared about, like, the integrity of, you know, intellectual property and, like, designs and innovation in fashion and people actually being original. It was people who were coming from a place of caring about that.
I see what you're saying. So basically, I also, the word I was thinking of was watchdog.
Oh, shit.
No, because I think the fashion industry is such a legacy industry and it's gone unchecked for so long. Like, it truly has so many facets of it that are so fucked up and systemically, like, ingrained within it and baked into it. And it's just like, that's what it is. And people have accepted it for so long that, yeah, Diet Prada came out and they're revolutionary because they were finally checking people.
But, you know, I feel
like, and brands, that's the most important part.
A lot of the time when we have someone criticizing the fashion industry, it's someone who doesn't have like a love for fashion, and that is something that's really easy to dismiss. If you do love fashion, it's coming from a voice that like just doesn't understand it. But like, Diet Prada understood fashion.
It was a love for fashion.
They were knowledgeable about it. They wanted to see the industry do better because they cared about the future of the industry. And I think that's why they were particularly refreshing.
Totally. I think that that is how they kind of carved their way. And it was like, they were the first of their kind almost. When I was thinking about kind of like what they are, I think they operate somewhere on the spectrum between vigilante and journalist in a weird way.
Yeah.
It's vigilanteism because it lacks restraint and it uses kind of aggression as a tactic against its targets. But instead of operating like in the dark or on the fringes like a vigilante would, and for free, it's all kind of mainstream and in the public eye, like journalism is.
They're kind of part of this wave of people who are not trained journalists, who haven't learned about the ethics and like the complications of journalism, being able to have the platform of a journalist because they've like amassed a following.
Which is incredibly lucky.
Lucky, but dangerous.
Dangerous, yeah. So in the Vanity Fair article I kind of referenced earlier, they interview a Business of Fashion reporter named Lauren Sherman, who kind of contributes her two cents to what she kind of thinks is wrong with Diet Prada, which is essentially the same issue that I had with them in my comment. She's quoted in the piece as saying, I thought they would evolve into something more responsible, and they in some ways became more irresponsible. And then she compares them to Fashionista. I don't know if you know what that is.
I don't.
It had basically started out as a blog run by one woman and then evolved into something of like a digital magazine. And since their readership is so large, I think it was at 2.5 million at the time the article was written, Fashionista had to kind of regroup and start adhering to like basic newsroom standards. And I think this is a really great comparison for Dia Prada, because it seems like, regardless of the fact that they're so big and they have like a manager now and they have like sponsorship deals and money, they're conducting themselves in the same way that they had when they were like a small niche account.
Yeah. And well, it's like if they were just reviewing fashion lines, or even what they were doing with calling out plagiarism, I don't necessarily think that you would need to have like the pedigree of like a journalist to do that.
Mm-hmm.
But I think when they got into territory, I don't know if you were going to bring this up, but with the Alexander Wang stuff.
I wasn't, so please.
They've played a role in like the kind of Me Tooing of a few fashion figures, like Alexander Wang, who was recently, a few years ago, called out for what seems like a history of like serial sexual assault and like predation in the fashion industry.
Yeah.
I believe that they were there like live reporting as it unfolded, reporting about stuff with Bruce Weber.
Who's a famous fashion photographer. He kind of created that entire Abercrombie photography aesthetic and then was found to be abusing his models.
Yeah, and I think that they've done it a few times with names that aren't as big, but like photographers and like men mostly in the industry who were abusing their positions. And it was kind of like important that there was somebody that was willing to say it, because the fashion industry is kind of like a let's bury things down
and a hub for sexual industry abuse and harassment. Yeah.
But then at the same time, I remember feeling a little weird about the vigilantism aspect of it, because Dia Prada, they aren't journalists, and like this is something really, really serious to be handled.
If you were to compare it to the way Ronan Farrow went about taking down Harvey Weinstein and like the process he had to go through to get that story, to break that story in the first place, like there is a process, a series of like steps you have to take in order to break a story publicly and to make it public. They don't have to take those steps.
Yeah, it just felt like a lot of power for what is an Instagram account.
Yeah, exactly.
To have taken on. But then at the same time, I mean, all the stuff with Dolce & Gabbana, they were doing something good that maybe no one else was going to necessarily. I mean, I think people would have lent a platform to those stories, especially with someone as big as Alexander Wang. But I think for like smaller designers and photographers and like people in the fashion industry that were also had misconduct, I don't know if larger publications would have been talking about that.
Well, also it's kind of coming, and I want to talk about this in this episode, because I just like, I love journalism. I think I grew up wanting to be a journalist, and I think it's like a beautiful occupation, I think. But right now it's undergoing this huge crisis. And one huge aspect now is that we're in this chicken and egg scenario, which is like, what influences what? Does social media influence news media, or does news media influence social media? And at this point, it's becoming completely difficult to tell. Even within news media itself, a lot of publications aren't actually doing the journalistic work to break stories. They're just repeating what other publications are doing to break the stories, right? So yeah. Like Dia Prada sometimes is breaking stories, and then the news outlets come and break that story. Sometimes the news outlets are breaking the story, and then Dia Prada repeats what the news outlets are saying, but it's becoming impossible to tell who did it first and who is actually doing the journalistic work to do it.
Well, yeah, and also, like, oftentimes now, like, the first source from a story will be someone's, like, social media post.
A post or, like, a DM to Dia Prada directly, which is, like, what is that?
Yeah, also, like all journalism, like Dia Prada has had to kind of make a lot more room in its feed for sponsored content, I guess, in order to continue funding
to sustain itself,
its existence. And yeah, like traditional news media, unfortunately, like devastatingly, is also in that position where things are now more about the money than they should be.
And that's a perfect segue, because like, again, for one, they're working with brands and providing them with positive reviews for their collections. And sometimes they'll switch it up fast, too. Like, A few years ago, they criticized Gucci for plagiarizing this really well-known tailor in Harlem named Dapper Dan. And then Gucci apologizes and brings them on to go onto their, like, Instagram story and analyze different inspirations from a recent Gucci collection on the official Gucci Instagram account. And Dio Prada later acknowledged in 2019 that Gucci had given them their first break with this.
But I think there's an interesting story there about Dapper Dan and Gucci. I think that it amounted to Dapper Dan getting to do, like, proper...
Yeah, it did. Collab. It did have some positive change. But then, aside from that, Dio Prada also got a little bit of a leg up, right? So it's not even like their growth on the site is necessarily organic through, like, the grassroots, like, whatever, no. Posts and algorithms. It had come piecemeal partly from brand recognition.
Well, because the gatekeepers of the fashion industry are still going to be the ones that give you the most...
The opportunities.
Yeah.
So it's kind of like they're very easily bought out. And yeah. Now brands, because, you know, take Gucci, for instance, with this scenario, are incentivized to do the song and dance of shaking hands with Dio Prada publicly and giving them a little bit of clout and calling it a day. Yeah. That's like a politician taking kickbacks.
Yeah.
But I do want to go back for a second because I don't want to pretend that journalism itself is like this perfect objective body either, right? Like,
no.
It isn't. For the most part, I don't believe, I think you and I both have this worldview. Like, I don't believe in objectivity. I think that anything touched by humans will have subjectivity imbued in it.
Even the way that we can frame certain news publications as right wing or left wing or feminist or whatever, like, it means that everything is coming at the news and, like, current events through a specific lens.
And they will always have outside interests as well, right? That, unfortunately, very, very below the line are influencing them, whether we like it or not.
Yes, many, many, many.
And this goes for everything, like technology, journalism, government. Everything's touched by humans.
It's all
everything
capitalism.
Yeah, and capitalism is also driven by humans. Dio Prada is only run by two people, so there is so much room for human
still
error.
Still to this day.
I don't know about to this day, but either it's two people or a very small team. At the time of the article that I was reading, which I think was last year, it was just two.
I mean, I guess, like, they can't be making enough money to fund them, their lives and, like, a small team.
Well, they haven't.
Yeah.
But, like, journalism hasn't been perfect either. I want to take the Leveson Inquiry as an example. Have you heard of it?
No.
So for those of you who don't know, the Leveson Inquiry was a series of public hearings in the UK back in 2011 into the culture and role of the British press.
Oh.
After News International, which is owned by Rupert Murdoch, had been caught hacking phones, bribing police.
I have heard
of
this.
It was a huge thing, and other really unethical practices when they were breaking stories. I think there was a murder case where they had hacked into the voicemail of the victim.
Yeah.
During the time of these public hearings, which were instigated by David Cameron, like the Prime Minister, several British journalistic bodies, some of which are genuine parasites. Like, I think both you and I, having worked on the Love Island video, know what the British press is like.
They're famous for it.
They're rabid.
Just watch Notting Hill.
Yeah, it's terrible. They were up in arms about this, and it ended up getting dropped by the Tories. David Cameron was a Tory, but it ended up getting dropped by the Tories in 2018 for, like, a multitude of reasons.
Okay.
But they did. It did lead to a lot of questions about journalism and what it means to our society. And so this article I had read for a journalism class that I took, which honestly was mind-blowing. It was like a life-changing class. I loved it. It was called Who Watches the Watchdogs? British Newspaper Meta-Discourse on the Leveson Inquiry. And it has a lot of interesting things to say about what journalism, like, purports to be in our society and what it actually is. And they have this quote. They say, libertarian press theory posits that the primary role of journalism in a democracy is to act as a watchdog of powerful interests, holding them to account for their actions and preventing abuses of power, though this watchdog role is often less of a reflection of contemporary practice than a product of journalism's internal myth-making. Which is interesting. So basically what they're saying is that journalism as a body, like as the fifth estate, often likes to pretend that it's above criticism or accountability, mm-hmm. and that it's mythologized its righteousness to such a degree that even the concept of a journalistic body being held accountable is completely unfathomable. Mm-hmm. And that's what these outlets were saying. And I do get it here, because if a government starts exercising its power against the watchdog, then the watchdog is no longer, like, free and independent. We don't have a freedom of press, and that's the bedrock of democracy.
Yeah, it is kind of a catch-22.
It is, and the catch-22 is who watches the watchdog.
Yeah.
Because who does? And that's a dilemma I think I have with Dio Prada, but it's even crazier because Dio Prada is operating on the frontiers of social media, so there are literally no laws.
Oh, yeah, it's
at
lawless.
All.
Wild West.
Exactly. So what do you think about Instagram, like, as a medium for this kind of thing? Do you think it's a good conduit for this kind of vigilante journalism, whatever that Dio Prada's doing?
I have just complicated feelings about vigilante journalism in general, especially when those journalists that are doing it aren't journalists. Obviously, I think it's great if somebody who has learned the ethics and practices of journalism is independently researching and reporting on something. Sometimes you have to do that. So you have to do it outside of all the things we've mentioned earlier about like working for a publication and like the kinds of restraints and like censorship that might put on you. But Diet Prada, they aren't journalists. And social media generally, and yeah, I guess Instagram allows for people to put on their little journalist hats, especially if you're an anonymous page, and like speak as an authority for something that you aren't.
And there is a huge privilege to anonymity, right? The amount of abuse that journalists get, particularly female journalists, is fucking insane. But like the anonymity before they can't be, you know, became public, is such a privilege to have. Well, no, and I like what you're saying to the code of ethics. Like, journalistic bodies do have a code of ethics that they have to adhere to. Like, there are associations of journalists in every single country that enforces these regulations upon them.
This is a small example and, like, not super relevant, but both my parents work for the in different departments, but my dad works in the newsroom as a copy editor. But because he is, like, touching what goes into the news, like growing up or still, my parents aren't allowed to put political signs on their front porch during elections. Like, they're not allowed to publicly associate themselves with political parties. And he's not even the one like presenting the news or like writing it. Mm-hmm. He's just a copy editor.
And it's not objectivity, it's like neutrality. Like, you have to try to be as neutral and distant as possible, because what are the checks and balances? How are they going to be laid out? They're going to be unfair.
Yeah. So I think it is really, really important, and like pretend that Diet Prada, they're journalists, to then also kind of want to be like bedfellows with the industry that you're supposed to be calling out. I mean, it's kind of the same as how weird it is when journalists and like politicians all get dressed up for like balls together, where it's like, okay, so you guys are also all pals.
Rubbing shoulders. Like, yeah. Exactly. And going back to what we've been saying about the passion thing, right? Everyone who loves fashion, you want to be a part of it in some way. Like, we can all acknowledge that the fashion industry is fucked up, but like, if you want a career and your vocation is in fashion, you want to be in it. And like, so there seems to be a part of like the two of them that wants to kind of be in this, but it's this double-edged sword, because it's like they want to be in it, but they also want the privileges of being outside of it and like criticizing it. And it's like, unfortunately, like, I don't think you can have both.
I mean, the thing is that I genuinely haven't really heard about many contributions that they've made to the criticism of the fashion industry in the last few years. Maybe I haven't been looking, but I don't think that they've made any like major splash lately.
I think it's kind of fallen off a little bit, yeah.
Because they've become more ingrained in fashion. They've become people who are invited to shows, who get to go see previews of collections, probably know designers or people on their teams.
Exactly. And so it's like, how are they going to enforce this? Again, going back, like, the internet really is the Wild West. Like, it truly is. It's the Wild West with my own job too. I say this like very often. I say this in terms of like sponsorships. If I speak to someone who's kind of trying to get into the YouTube world, because we have a Discord and like sometimes people will ask, it's kind of defunct now. At the time, there were smaller YouTubers kind of asking, what do they do with sponsorships? How much do they set their rate? And it's like, there's actually no regulations at this point. There's no regulations for how any of this works. Even thinking about it, like the absolute hell you have to go through to get a thesis approved so that your research can be posted publicly, or like published, you know, for the public to see at a university, is absolutely insane. Especially if you wanted to use human participants, like the research ethics process is crazy. It is hard to get stuff posted publicly, but on YouTube, like, I'm churning out essays nonstop to the public constantly, and there's really like no body that's gonna hold me accountable for that. I could say whatever the fuck I want. I could lie to all of you all the time intentionally, people will hold me accountable. Like, a mob would hold me accountable.
You can say whatever you want as an independent body. Like, you're not.
Exactly.
Yeah, you're not really.
But it is dangerous. Like, it is dangerous because social media is so influential. It's more influential, I'm scared to say, than news media these days.
I don't even think that that's a hot take. I think that that's the news is influenced by social media. It is very influential.
It's incredibly scary. I think it fits into our theme pretty well, this Diet Prada conversation, just in a different way than the other episodes, I think. I have my own perspective about this, but how do you feel like it plays into the whole idea of public villains?
They are the ones that have casted a lot of public villains. And even though I'm sure people are critical of them, and I'm sure there are articles that are critical of them, there's never been any kind of like reckoning with Diet Prada. And it's not that I actually think that there needs to be one specifically, but I do think that we need to have a bit of a conversation about the kinds of faux journalism that they represent. Mm-hmm. They are not a public villain, but they've created many.
Yeah, they've made a career out of creating public villains.
Yeah.
For me, it feels like Diet Prada like knows that it'll maintain its foothold in pop culture for a very long time. Really? Because human beings are drawn to sensational villains. They're making like whatever random news fluff, but I do think they've built this entire brand off of this sort of negative, sensational villain making. Their entire brand of negativity, like even the posts they make now are quite negative, even if they have nothing to do with fashion.
Are they relevant? I noticed that they were posting sponsored content for the movie Babylon, where they just posted a bunch of memes. I just can't tell if I'm just become less interested or if they've like dialed back. It really could just be I'm the problem.
But anyway, but I'm talking more about just like their general brand right now. Like yes, I'm talking about who they are and like what we know them as, not what they're doing right now necessarily specifically. You know, many times they have been progressive and like effectively dismantled or like at least throttled harmful systems, and they've done a good job of instilling fear in the fashion industry that wasn't there before. But they also like really relish in bullying people publicly. And because it's on social media, they're grabbing our attention with like pictures and flashy captions, and they're sort of making entertainment out of this public villainry.
Are these public villains just, you know, designers and like influencers?
I'm not saying people aren't deserving of it. I'm just saying that that's what they do. That is their brand. It doesn't matter whether or not they're people are deserving. It's more the question of what Diet Prada is as a brand, which is that. Like, for example, one time they put out this post criticizing The Gap for partnering with Kanye West.
Oh, yeah.
And this was all before his, like, recent anti-Semitic remarks. But he had still said quite a few, like, fucked up things in public. Yeah. I think this was his, like, slavery was a choice era. But, yeah, then they got, like, in a bunch of trouble because the post had featured these memes of, like, fake Yeezy t-shirts that said MAGA and slavery was a choice on them. Which, obviously, if you're looking at Diet Prada, you would immediately think that that's actually what Yeezy had put out.
I mean, that's not a far cry.
No, but then it wasn't actually Kanye who was artistically driving this project. It was like a much smaller Nigerian designer named, I don't want to mess up her name, Moalola Ogunlesi. I hope I didn't butcher that. Who had helmed that project. Sidestepping the criticisms against them, they made this post with like little research in a very tone deaf, very unjournalistic way. Like, it doesn't matter whether or not what he did was close to that. You're making memes out of breaking a story.
That's right? True.
Like, you shouldn't be making memes about that. Because, but their guerrilla grip over our culture makes it feel like they're safe. They can make memes. They can make sport out of this. They can make these toxic posts.
Yeah, it is this weird kind of middle ground between, like, talking about very serious issues, but then, like, make it Instagram. Like, it has to still be visually interesting.
Well, it's literally as if the Washington Post had an Instagram that literally made memes about, like, the Gaza Strip. It's like, what are you doing? Like, obviously, it's not the same thing, but it is, like, if you're trying to be taken seriously, then I don't know if you can be teetering entertainment and serious breaking stories. Or, like, maybe split them up. One post is an entertainment post that is specifically about some fluff subject, and another post is about breaking a story. Like, you can't be merging the two.
I know. I do think it is, because they're a team of two, like, just trying to churn out content, and like, that requires less effort, or like, it requires you to be less extensive in your fact checking and everything.
Yeah, because it's the Wild West. Like, you just don't have to. Kimberly M. Jenkins, who's an assistant professor of fashion studies, and she's also the founder of the Fashion Race Database, has a really good quote about kind of like what Diet Prada is and what its role in our culture is, which I don't think is necessarily journalistic. I think it more has to do with they kind of innovated this late 2010s era of call-out culture. She says, "What Diet Prada is doing is encouraging everyone to deputize themselves and give themselves the authority to go after someone and drag them into the public forum."
Yeah.
And I do think that it really did almost officiate that.
Oh, totally. I mean, I think it came at the rise of social media journalism, if that's what we're going to call it. Again, amongst these movements like, you know, Me Too, which had actual journalists like breaking the stories and wasn't exactly the same, but was based in a lot of crowdsourcing information through the internet. We had that like list going around of bad media men that got leaked. Mm-hmm. And through that, we learned about all the men who had like these crazy indiscretions, like working in the entertainment industry, crazy indiscretions, who had allegations towards them.
Crazy indiscretions.
Sorry. Brain fart. I don't know, that was 2017, 2018. That's around the rise of like Diet Prada. I do think that it played a role in this wave and it made people go, oh, I can like become an authority on this thing. Think about like Dumois, which is, you know, way less serious, but Dumois is like an anonymous celebrity.
Which has its own whole host of problems.
Oh, Dumois is fascinating to me, but we don't know who they are. And they post celebrity content, but like very quickly realize that they could be getting themselves in like libel trouble. So now they basically will have like tea, but they omit any details about who the gossip is about. But then we'll also like repost people's pictures of like random people eating, like celebrities eating sandwiches that That's they really like funny. Saw on the street in New York or whatever. But like
the blind items.
I don't think we would have a Dumois if we didn't have Diet Prada. I know they're different, but it kind of felt like, you know, you've got Me Too, Diet Prada, Dumois.
They feel like a souped up Perez Hilton sometimes, to be completely honest. Like, that is for fashion. There's something weirdly deterministic to me about, like, social media fame. For some reason, it's almost impossible in my brain to begin a career on there without completely selling out. Like, I feel slightly like this about my own career, which kind of goes back to the concept of constantly having to hustle. Like, once you start, you can't stop. I don't know how you feel about that in relation to this.
Well, no, like, I've seen you be like, I want to put out a well-researched, well-written, like, smart contribution to my medium. But also, there is a time constraint. I am having to meet the deadlines of the people that are going to give me my livelihood. And you're only one person. I think that anybody who makes their money in social media probably feels the exact same way.
Yeah, it's that like capitalist trap of needing to keep growing and diversifying and like keeping up the productivity or like always be optimizing, as Gia Tolentino says. But that isn't sustainable in many cases, like this one, for example. Or it kind of reminds me of Emma Chamberlain and that whole discussion around relatable girlies aren't relatable anymore. Like all those vloggers who gained a following off of being like average girls, but then the following got so big and they started making a ton of money and like it just wouldn't stop. Yeah. And now they aren't regular girls anymore. They're like millionaires, multimillionaires. Also, like,
the people from Diet Prada were working in fashion and like,
but definitely lower down though. Sure. They were like,
but probably with the aspirations of having higher places in fashion. And I think obviously they're gonna become more wrapped up in fashion in a way that makes them less objective as their success grows, because ultimately that's probably what they wanted the whole time, not necessarily from Diet Prada, but like as career goals.
But if you make a brand out of an entire career out of pointing fingers, like you better make sure you're in fucking tip-top form, because like people will turn it on you. It's this double-edged thing of like you want more followers, but then the following keeps growing and there's no way to keep it what it used to be. But it's like you have to adjust and adapt, and like it just feels like they're adjusting and adapting in like the worst possible way.
I think sometimes you just get too big to be contained. That might be the case for them. Like they're not actually gonna fit in the box of what Diet Prada was supposed to serve and like function as they become more ingrained in the fashion industry. Like, I just don't think the two things can, like, coexist. And I think when you're operating as, like, anonymous and you don't actually hold any power in the industry, you're able to get away with a lot more.
It is sad, though, because it's, like, I would love to do something as a hobby. I think they started this out of, like, sheer love for fashion and out of, like, hobbyism and like, activism, honestly. Because they turned it into a full-time job, that just completely compromises like the ethics and even like public appeal of that job, which is so interesting because it's like we're in this really transitional time where it's like we're transitioning from the internet being this like ad hoc, like democratize, like for the people space to this like completely corporate top down, I don't even know what it is, hell dystopia. And now it's this place where people are making money and careers. My career is on social media, yours with this podcast soon might be too. And it's like, and it is partially your career is like working with me and stuff. Like it is partly on there too. And it's scary. I don't know if I like where it's going. And Diet Prada really feels like an emblem of that to me.
But I think that, see, Diet Prada is like an earlier case of this, right? I think when they were starting to blow up, they probably weren't thinking about the intricacies of this. And like, I don't think anyone was necessarily looking at like the big picture issue of the internet economy. And like, even if you're not an influencer, if you are making money the way an influencer makes money, you are going to sort of fall into that. And so Diet Prada, they're not influencers, but I don't know, they're adjacent. It's a similar economy. If you know, yeah. If you get what I mean, like you're making your money off of like views and like sponsorships.
Yeah.
And I think probably through watching people like them, I don't know, you're probably weighing that in the decisions you make.
Yeah, I try to keep up as much integrity as I possibly can, but sometimes I have kind of lost it. Like
you could be turning out like two videos a month and they'd be not as high quality or like well-researched, but you'd be making more money. This is something I've seen you actively decide not to do.
Yeah, I do think, to me, like, integrity is, like, the most important thing. I'm not saying that I have always had integrity with the choices I've made, but, like, I try my best. I, like, really try to keep up, like, an ethical practice. Because there is no regulations, like, you have to self-regulate. Like, you have to regulate yourself and make sure that you are enforcing checks and balances on yourself. And that's so hard, but I think it's, like, you have to just go by what your moral compass tells you.
And make sure you're not blinded by like the pretty shiny things. But Diet Prada, they're working in fashion. There's a lot of pretty shiny things, and I think that they went for them. And yeah, unfortunately, that does mean their integrity is compromised.
In the Watchdog article, they say, I like this quote, but they say, "There's a discomforting irony in journalism's readiness to cast its gaze upon other powerful actors while being a shrinking violet when it comes to scrutiny of its own power." And I think it's interesting because Diet Prada kind of swings back and forth when it comes to scrutinizing itself. Like, when I called them out, they were really quick to be very defensive and aggressive. But when the criticism has been, like, too big, like, mob criticism, they'll sometimes, like, delete a post or they'll create an apology, like, with the Kanye situation. And then in this GQ article, they were quoted as saying, "A lot of our part in call-out culture has been born out of an interest and need from the community, which we've been happy to serve despite the pressure and the growing number of eyeballs on the account. But as more individual leaders emerge from this shift that's happening, it's likely we'll get to a place where we don't need call-out culture as we know it." But then I'm like, wow, what happens to your career if call-out culture doesn't exist? What's going to happen to you guys?
Wait, is the idea that everybody is so scared of being called out that no one's doing anything worth being called out over? I'm confused.
No, I think that they're saying that they almost catalyzed a shift where all these recent events have also catalyzed a shift where people who have a lot of sway and power are comfortable with also changing like the tides of how progressiveness works and like our world works and like creating systemic change. And if that's happening more rapidly, then we won't need to be calling people out because our world has progress more, is what they're trying to say.
I think that's just like them being like, yeah, hopefully in the future we won't have to do that. We'd want a future where we don't have to do the thing that we do. It's like, that's I want world peace.
That's optimistic, you know? About like the human condition too, because we're even seeing the way that call-out culture has kind of evolved over the past few years and how incredibly toxic and like self-cannibalizing it's become. Diet Prada is just so interesting to me because I personally, like, I love fashion. Like, I've always loved it. I've always been very interested in it, compelled by it. I like to learn about it. And I really, really believed in them when they first started.
I loved them.
I thought they were so cool and great. And I thought what they were doing was so interesting and important. But I think that they're just such a, not even a cautionary tale, because, like, they're thriving right now. They have millions of followers. But to me, it's sad to see that. I sympathize and empathize with them that it was this thing that they couldn't stop and it was growing and growing. But I do think that they should have sat down and really, really had a discussion about like what kind of integrity they wanted to have. And I think that they completely lost it.
Yeah. I mean, I think that they also probably should have had a conversation with themselves like earlier about how much they wanted to lean into this idea of being like the newsbreakers and like the truth tellers, and how much they actually just wanted to talk about fashion. Because I think once we started looking at them as somebody that was going to like tell us something that no one else in fashion was going to say, then it confused what the original mission of the page was, which I think was just to like be snarky and call out when one person was...
Give credence to smaller brands, really.
Give like, credence to other brands, but also be like, hey, that looks like archival Balmain and this other house is doing it. And just wanting more like innovation in fashion. I think that would have been fine. I think we're going to talk about this next week in our Man Repeller episode.
Ooh.
But I think that when something starts with one objective that might lean a little bit into... something political or something more like bigger picture and people latch onto it, I think that they assume that they are capable of taking on more in that political direction
than they really have the means and the toolkit to do.
The means or like the actual desire to.
Yeah.
Right? Like if people are looking at you as the people who called out Dolce & Gabbana because of something racist, then they're going to look for you to do all of that kind of work when it happens in other cases.
Mm-hmm.
And then you're going to be asked to talk about more and more topics that like you as like a fashion Instagram might not be like the authoritative voice on and might not want to be.
It truly really is a stay in your fucking lane situation.
Yeah.
I'm not saying don't be progressive and don't talk about like racism and sexism and stuff, but like if you're going to be a fashion account, just be a fashion account, talk about it within fashion. You don't need to be doing everything. They're just trying to do everything and it ends up being like the quality just doesn't exist. The quality, and really at the end of the day, the message I want to get across is like protect journalists. Like journalism is so important. This episode like really just made me think about that. It's so important and we need journalism and we need ethical journalism and we need to give it money and we need to support it because it's in crisis. And Dia Prada cannot be our journalistic body. Please.
I can't think of a clever last quip.
What it, as Miranda Priestly says...
Oh, yeah, you told me there was going to... I thought there was going to be more Devil Wears Prada.
I did, but then you said what I was going to say.
Oh, shit. I'm sorry.
Actually, we just wanted to end the episode with this.
This stuff.
Oh, okay. I see. You think this has nothing to do with you. You go to your closet and you select, I don't know, that lumpy blue sweater, for instance, because you're trying to tell the world that you take yourself too seriously to care about what you put on your back. But what you don't know is that that sweater is not just blue, it's not turquoise, it's not lapis, it's actually cerulean. You're also blithely unaware of the fact that in 2002, Oscar de la Renta did a collection of cerulean gowns, and then I think it was Yves Saint Laurent, wasn't it?
who showed cerulean military jackets. I think we need a jacket here.
And then cerulean quickly showed up in the collections of eight different designers. Then it filtered down through the department stores and trickled down into some tragic casual corner where you no doubt fished it out from some clearance bin. However, that blue represents millions of dollars of countless jobs, and it's sort of comical how you think you made a choice that exempts you
from the...
When in fact, you're wearing a sweater that was selected for you
by the people in this room from a pile of stuff. She... Goes too fast.
Let's do from a pile of stuff at the same time.
One, two, three.
Rehash is hosted by Hannah Rain and me, Maia. It's produced and edited by me, and the intro and outro song is produced by our talented friend, Ian Mills. Thanks for listening.